We recited the I Have a Dream speech, maybe talked a little bit about George Washington Carver, and, you know, that was about it. But like everything in America, the history of black Americans in this country is layered and a lot deeper than just two or three individuals. So we are looking to expand the canon, so to speak, and also shake it up. Now, I know a lot of you are thinking, do we even need a Black History Month? I mean, we've progressed, right? Haven't we? Well, that's the question one filmmaker had a couple years ago. Shakri Thyman wrote and directed the movie More Than a Month, which, I have to say, when I heard the content, kind of shocked me.
I always joke with people that it's a good one-line pitch. What is your documentary about? It's about my one-year journey to end Black History Month.
So tell me, like, where did this idea come from?
It really came from an interview that I saw with Morgan Freeman on 60 Minutes in 2005.
Black History Month, you find
ridiculous.
Why?
You're going to relegate my history to a month?
Oh, come on.
What do you do with yours? I don't want a Black History Month. Black history is American history.
This was not the first time that I had heard that or felt that myself. So I thought, oh, this would be interesting to explore this idea and as a way to looking at Black History Month as a way to look at how we treat history, what it means to treat a history a certain way, and what that says about race and inequality in the U.S.
When I heard exactly where you were coming from and the concepts behind it, I'm totally on board with it. I think it makes sense. I think that the problem with quote-unquote Black history is that it kind of puts us in a box of, like, this is the only time you should talk about it. But just playing a little bit of devil's advocate, if we don't have that box, I'm curious if we'll ever talk about it at all.
That's the number one fear, that then what will you be left with? But for me, that was always even more the reason to be vigilant about why you have it or not. Because in other words, if the only thing separating African American history from being properly exposed or not is a month, then there's something wrong with that. That history shouldn't be so reliant on a holiday in order to be exposed.
See, and I would say that I think we do need it. You know, when Obama was elected, the thing that everybody was talking about is that, you know, the question was, have we entered a post-racial America? And I think that that question alone demands that we continue to have a Black History Month to speak to that.
Yeah, I can understand where you're coming from. I mean, you know, we can't get confused that as long as we keep pumping up February, that we've somehow won. The win is in, there were a lot of black movies, for example, or movies that had African Americans. 2013 was a big year. Normative process. They didn't all come out in February. They just came out throughout the year. They were wide release films, et cetera, et cetera. That's a normative process, something that just happens as a part of being part of a culture and a society. And if February precludes that, or if the attention on February precludes that from happening, then that's not a victory.
Outside of public radio, I I'm a performance artist, I'm a playwright, I do a bunch of different things. And, you know, I tend to get booked a lot during Black History Month. What you just said, though, like, connects to that, because, like, if we can get to a point where you're getting booked all the time to speak about these issues outside of Black History Month, then we've really made some progress.
Right, that's true. Then you would kind of know. Now, I mean, again, that's why it's a tricky issue, because look, I mean, you know, this film has the perfect irony, because it is a film about ending Black History Month, yet it aired nationally on PBS in Black History Month.
Right.
90% of the screenings of it are in Black History Month. So it's kind of like eating itself. It's weird.
That is my point, is that, like, you know, I hear everything you're saying and you're 100% right. But then they're going to air your damn movie on Black History Month. That's Shakri Thyman, who wrote and directed the movie More Than a Month. So, do we need a Black History Month? I'm leaning towards yes, because I don't think we're at the point where Black history has totally been entwined with regular old American history. I mean, it's the same thing, and yet somehow it isn't. I think it has to do with the fact that a lot of American history, as it pertains to African Americans, is hard to swallow. For example, something tragic happened in Tulsa in 1921, but the story was buried under layers of silence for a very long time. We went there to explore what happened, and how history has been written and rewritten over the decades.
Hey, Don.
Right now, we're in Greenwood, a historic neighborhood just north of Tulsa's downtown, and we're getting a tour from Reuben Gant, a Tulsa native, and I just have to say, a huge man. He was a tight end with the Buffalo Bills in a former life. Now, he spends a lot of his time in Greenwood, and he might know the area better than anyone in the city.
It's one block. It's 10 adjoining buildings on either side of the street. Some buildings are as old as circa 1922.
For years, Reuben worked for the Greenwood Chamber of Commerce, which works to preserve the history and promote the developments of this neighborhood. It used to be a thriving African-American business district during the first decades of the 1900s. As we walk, he points out bronze plaques set into the sidewalk.
Let's see. T. Bridgewater, doctor, very prominent in the community. The Oklahoma Sun newspaper, not reopened.
These plaques, they give this place a ghostly quality. They commemorate businesses that used to line the stretch before the whole neighborhood was wiped off the map in a single night, in something that's been called the Tulsa Race Riot.
You know, it's good for people to know what was here and what is here now.
But the ironic thing is that for the first half of Reuben's life, even he didn't know about the history, even though his great aunt and uncle survived it.
I didn't learn about the riot until I was an adult, out of college. I mean, I was a little devastated, a little bit in shock, because I was born and raised here. And for it not to have been talked about, to me, was surprising.
But not, as it turns out, unusual. A whole generation of Tulsans, both black and white, grew up knowing little about this dark chapter in the city's past. We'll explore exactly how the history was erased and then recovered in just a bit. But first, let's rewind almost a century to Greenwood's heyday.
Well, the Greenwood District here in Tulsa, also known as the Negro Wall Street or Black Wall Street, was a burgeoning African-American business community.
That's Hannibal Johnson, a Tulsa-based lawyer and historian who's written a couple books on the 1921 incident and the beginnings of Greenwood.
A fellow named O.W. Gurley started a grocery store, and from that one business, a number of other businesses proliferated. Doctors and lawyers, movie theaters, dance halls.
Drugstores, hotels, a bank, a hospital.
That's Reuben again. His family has roots in this area going back almost 150 years.
It was billed as the promised land for blacks.
Throughout the early 1900s, Greenwood flourished, becoming kind of a city within a city. Dollars circulated over and over through the Greenwood economy, and black-owned businesses prospered. But while Greenwood is often recalled as a kind of black utopia, the country beyond looked very different. Lynchings were on the rise, the KKK was strong, and by the spring of 1921, race relations in Tulsa were tense. On May 31st, something sparked the tinderbox.
The trigger incident was an incident between two teenagers. Dick Rowland, 19-year-old black Shushan boy who dropped out of Booker T. Washington High School because he knew he could make money downtown shining shoes for some of these wealthy oil men. Sarah Page, a white girl, who operated the elevator in the downtown Drexel building.
On the day of the massacre, Dick needed to use the bathroom. He went to the Drexel knowing there was one on the top floor. He got in the elevator.
The door closed. Something happened that caused the elevator to jerk or to lurch, and Dick Rowland bumped into Sarah Page.
Now, what exactly happened in that elevator is debated. Some say it was an assault, others say Dick and Sarah were involved, which would have been a major scandal at the time. Whatever the case may be, something happened that caught the attention of a clerk at a nearby store who came to Sarah Page's assistance.
And unfortunately, when the Tulsa Tribune got wind of this story, it published an article called Nab Negro for Attacking Girl in an Elevator. And in this article, the Tulsa Tribune all but said Dick Rowland attempted to rape Sarah Page in broad daylight in a public space in Tulsa, and we cannot have that.
Dick Rowland was arrested and taken to the courthouse downtown.
The sheriff began to hear rumblings about town that there was going to be a lynching.
A white mob gathered outside the jail. A group of African-American men marched down from Greenwood to make sure that Dick was safe. At some point, someone fired a gun. And then...
members of the white mob looted pawn shops for weapons and marched into the Greenwood District over the Frisco tracks. And things just went haywire for a period of about 16 hours. Fires were set. The firemen were prevented from putting out the fires. Local law enforcement actually deputized some of the members of the white mob that invaded the Greenwood community.
The white mob forced people out of their houses, killed as many as 300, and burned over 1,000 businesses and homes to the ground.
I took my little girl by the hand and fled out of the west door on Greenwood.
There are not many survivors still alive today who remember their experiences that night, but we do have written accounts. Mary E. Parrish published one of the first books about the riot just a year after it happened. She described her own experiences fleeing from Greenwood with her young daughter. She headed out of town where a crowd of survivors were gathering.
The question on every lip when a newcomer from town would arrive was, how far had they burned when you left town?
Eventually, the city called in the National Guard to quell the riot, but they had to travel from Oklahoma City, 100 miles away. And by the time they arrived,
the Greenwood community was totally obliterated.
And in the decades that followed, the memory of the massacre was nearly obliterated too. We'll meet a few people who managed to keep it alive when So True continues.
On the next Fresh Air, some insights into cats. We talk with John Bradshaw, author of Cat Sense, how the new feline science can make you a better friend to your pet. Here's one of his tips. If your kitten is doing something it shouldn't,
you make the noise that mother cats do when they're telling their kittens off.
Join us.
Weekday mornings at 11 and again at 7 p.m. on AM 580.
Support for today's broadcast comes from Radio Maria in downtown Champaign. Along with their dinner menu, tapas is served every evening until 2 a.m. Brunch is also served on Saturday and Sunday from 10:30 to 2:30. Information on menus and wine and beer lists is at RadioMariaRestaurant.com.
I'm Al Letson, and this is State of the Reunion. We're in Tulsa exploring how the destruction of a thriving African-American neighborhood in 1921 left hundreds dead and thousands homeless. And it all but disappeared from public memory in the decades after it happened. A whole generation of Tulsans grew up hearing only whispers.
The stories were more or less told in hushed tones, and you'd almost have to kind of eavesdrop to hear them.
That's Scott Ellsworth, a historian who wrote one of the first full accounts of what happened. He grew up in Tulsa in the 1950s and 60s, and the incident did make a brief appearance in his 8th grade Oklahoma history textbook.
And the story was something like, well, there was an incident in an elevator, a bunch of people got mad, and things kind of got out of hand, and after that, white people in Tulsa made everything happy again.
Scott was mystified by this, and began doing some research on his own, sneaking to the downtown library to check out historic records on microfilm.
There were a few photographs you could find in national magazines or in newspapers, and it, you know, it looked like Hiroshima or Nagasaki. It didn't look like Tulsa. But I didn't really know how to put any of this together or what it meant, and certainly the account in the 8th grade history textbook told me this was nothing, you know, of interest.
Now, consider that. 50 years after the riot, and nothing of interest? In the days immediately following the incident, it made front page news all over the world. New York, Chicago, London, India. and the political and business interests in Tulsa quickly realized the event was horrible publicity for a young, vibrant oil town that hoped to draw more people to it.
What happened is sort of remarkable. I mean, records were destroyed. There were missing National Guard reports. Old bound copies of the Tulsa Tribune were carefully clipped out and destroyed. So it becomes erased from the public memory. This is something that isn't to be discussed publicly. People would talk about it privately.
Over the years, journalists, oral historians, and local activists, both black and white, tried to bring the story back into the public consciousness, and many faced silence or outright threats when they dug into the history. Still, it came out bit by bit. But it took another Oklahoma tragedy to really bring it back into the public eye.
This morning, an explosion occurred at the Alfred Murrah Federal Building in downtown Oklahoma City, a blast that was felt for miles away. Cars all around the outside of the building.
National media outlets poured into the state to cover the story of the Oklahoma City bombing in 1995. The Today Show sent its entire crew to broadcast live from Oklahoma City for a week. During that time, a state representative from Tulsa named Don Ross saw an opening.
Don Ross went up and approached Bryant Gumbel, who was then the Today Show host, and said, you know, Mr. Gumbel, as horrible as this incident is in Oklahoma City, we've had an even bigger incident in Tulsa that nobody ever has ever written about, nobody's done a story about.
He gave Gumbel a copy of Scott Ellsworth's book called Death in a Promised Land. Gumbel read it, and the Today Show ended up doing a story on the 75th anniversary of the riot in 1996.
The Ku Klux Klan had a strong foothold in Oklahoma, and lynchings were all too common.
That national news story inspired coverage across the country. And in the face of so much scrutiny, the state created a riot commission, tasked with studying the history and issuing a report about what had happened. It came out in 2001, 80 years after Greenwood burned to the ground. These days, it's mandated that teachers cover the Oklahoma City bombing. But until just recently, it was optional to cover the riot.
Hey, raise your hand if you still need a rubber band.
But some teachers, like Leanne Jimenez at the Mayo Demonstration School, have taken it upon themselves to cover the riot in depth. And in some ways, they go far beyond what Scott Ellsworth learned in his 8th grade history textbook.
You know, we do a lot of hands-on learning here, trying to provide students with real-life experiences as much as possible.
That's Kenneth Jocelyn, principal of the Mayo School. A few years ago, he and Leanne decided to carry out a teaching experiment. They started by taking 3rd, 4th, and 5th graders on field trips to the Greenwood area, teaching them about the history of the neighborhood. Each student chose a particular business to research and learned as much about it as they could.
And then we gave them 2x2 inch wooden blocks and had them create the businesses. So if it were a 2-story building, they had 2 blocks and they designed it and decorated it to look like the buildings of the time.
Whether it was a barber shop or it was a bakery, it was a home, whatever it was.
The kids were very proud of their work. They learned a lot about the history of our city. And one day they went home and we were talking afterwards about what a great job we had done, but could we do some more? And one of us said, you know, the race riot happened and the city was burned. We should burn the city.
So the teachers took the model of Greenwood outside, poured gasoline on it, and set it on fire.
And when they came in the next morning, they saw the devastation. And we just let them experience standing around it, taking in what had happened to all of their hard work.
Their reactions were, they were heartbreaking.
Something happened. We don't know what happened.
There were actually students in tears.
What happened? Who did this? Why would they? It all happened in 1921.
We had them write poetry. We had them write stories.
Racism, a disease that's deadly to the eye. Acts of kindness. Maybe if there had been, this wouldn't have happened.
Greenwood. Combined. Race riot. Enemy. Evil. Not right. Why? Odd. Opposite. Dead.
That's how they felt after we burned their stuff down. They really got a sense of what happened.
It wasn't the same as what the actual survivors experienced during that time, but it gave them a sense of, you know, having worked for a long, long period of time on a project and then just have somebody destroy it.
Some of the African-American students were very upset that the white people did this, and their emotions came through. Some of our Caucasian students were, you know, well, that's what you get for doing something like that in an elevator, you know? And it got very heated at times, but we did it within the confines of our school. We talked them through their emotions, and, you know, for the majority, they thought it was horrible that this kind of thing could happen to anyone, and it should never happen again.
The Mayo School is getting ready to repeat their experiment with a new batch of students. And even though the riot is talked about more openly these days, people still grapple with the legacy of what happened, the mysteries that remain, and how to teach an incomplete and painful history to a new generation. Several states away from Greenwood is another African-American business district that was once thriving, and now you'd barely know anything was there. But racism wasn't the cause of this one's demise. In fact, it may have been integration.
Right, so right now I am on Farish Street in Jackson, Mississippi, in front of the Big Apple Inn.
The Big Apple Inn is an iconic Mississippi restaurant. An old school, no frills kind of place people have been coming to their whole lives in Jackson.
I'm Gino Lee, the fourth generation owner of the Big Apple Inn. And we are inside the Big Apple Inn right now, prepping, getting things ready. The smoked sausage sandwiches, cutting pig ears, getting things ready for our lunch crowd.
Yep, he said pig ears.
Yeah. You know what a pig ear is?
I will in a second.
This is legendary. You can't eat just one. The hotter it is, the better it is. And I don't know what they put on it, Holy Grail or something, but it's good.
The Lee family has been serving pig ear sandwiches here since the early days of the 20th century. Gino's great-grandfather, who was a Mexican immigrant, had an outdoor hot tamale stand that he eventually converted into a storefront restaurant.
There was a store down the street that cut meat. It was a butcher.
That's Gino's dad, Gene Lee. He ran the Big Apple before Gino did. Now, the story goes that this butcher down the street was throwing away pig ears.
My grandfather, he knew what hunger was, so he wasn't going to throw away food, especially meat. So he gave him a box of pig ears. He said, what am I going to do with these pig ears? So he said, I'll boil them. So he boiled them, boiled them, boiled them.
He ended up boiling them for almost 3 days and finally got the ears tender.
He said, put this hot sauce that I put in my hot tamales on top of this pig ear and put it between two pieces of bread, a bun. He put it in on the menu, and it was an overnight success. People said, John, give me some of that, whatever it is. It sure tastes good. It was a pig ear sandwich.
And generations since have been coming to the Big Apple on Ferris Street for those pig ears. A line of people stand on one side of the counter, watching smoked sausage and pig ear sandwiches being flipped on a griddle and wrapped in wax paper to go. This place has its own rhythm, punctuated by the orders for smokes and ears.
They come in and say, can I have one smoke and one ear hot? Or can I have two hot smokes? Or can I have two hot ears?
All right, let me get two smokes. No, three smokes, light hot, and one ear, light hot.
It's a different taste. It's not like you can go up there and get a McDonald's hamburger and get me that same little burger. See, this one, you got a different flavor. You know, some kind of taste that you really want, you know. I crave for it all the time.
In the old days, the Big Apple was one of many prosperous black-owned businesses on Ferris Street. In fact, Ferris Street was one of the most successful black business districts in the nation, said to be second only to Harlem. And in the 1960s, that meant it became a hub of the civil rights movement, too.
Medgar had an office right above the Big Apple.
Gene Lee is talking about Medgar Evers, the slain civil rights leader who led the NAACP here in Jackson. The field office for the organization was right there in the thick of things. Here's Gene's son, Gino.
You know, during that time, Ferry Street was, if not the only, it was the largest population of black folks back then. So when Medgar came to have meetings, or when Martin Luther King came to have meetings, it all happened on Ferry Street. Marches happened on Ferry Street. Everything happened on Ferry Street.
But even with all that energy and activism, Gene Lee says he never imagined the day when the civil rights movement would achieve the goal of integration.
I didn't think that it would ever come to pass, that all of this marching and all of the riding of buses, I said, this is not worth a hill of beans. It was pie in the sky kind of, You know, it would never happen in Mississippi. In fact, my mother and father knew they would never see the day that things would be better for blacks.
And then, on July 2nd, 1964, the unbelievable happened.
My fellow Americans, I am about to sign into law the Civil Rights Act of 1964. Its purpose is national, not regional. Its purpose is to promote a more abiding commitment to freedom.
This was it. The moment the whole civil rights movement had been pushing to achieve. The promised land, so to speak. But after the triumph, after the euphoria wore off, what happened to Fair Street?
So right next to the Big Apple Inn is a boarded up storefront. And there's trash kind of hidden in the nooks and corners of the place. Glass, broken glass on the floor. And you can see it, but maybe more importantly, you can hear it. That silence, it's a little bit eerie. I mean, this whole area is filled with these places where businesses used to be, ghosts of the past that are abandoned and emptied.
And if you went down on Fair Street today, you know, you would shake your head and say, my, what on earth? It looked like a tornado had gone through.
We're the only business that's open on Fair Street right now.
Gene Lee says it happened gradually, but little by little, over the years, there was an exodus of black shoppers from the area.
After integration, many of us felt that white ice was colder than black ice. I think I was more eager to shop and do things that I couldn't do prior. Just have the freedom to go where I wanted to go without having to be told, you can't come in here or you can't do this.
I mean, that's natural, right? If something has been withheld from you for so long and you finally get the chance to try it, maybe what you used to have doesn't sparkle as much.
Now you see how the people look? That was typical of the era.
Dr. Wilma Clopton is leading us around a gallery full of pictures of Fair Street in its heyday in a museum founded by her mother back in the 1980s.
So what I see as an image in front of me is the image with which I grew up, of people who were poised, who were proud of themselves. And even if they did not have a formal education, you could expect those people also to have a pride in who they are and were.
These photos are of well-coiffed and stylishly dressed African-American men and women on Fair Street. Dr. Clopton says they're a clue to what was lost after integration. It was their sense of themselves. And she thinks it was lost because black folks received a message over and over again that
what you have is not as good as what you can get. So now, if you're told that what you have is okay, the district still survives with its, you know, beauty shops and its barber shops and its car dealers, if they were down here, and all the dining facilities, you would still be going to those. But now, they're not good enough. And you have access to other things which you probably don't own. And that's part of the demise of the district.
I think we stop talking about all of the things that affected African-American businesses across this country.
Otha Kane is a black Jacksonian who's lived in this city nearly all his life and been a radio host here for years. He says he only learned what Fair Street had been in the 1990s, years into its decline.
They forgot to pass the memo, right? And so what that literally means is all of this good stuff, all of this institutional knowledge, all of this history, all of these things, somebody stopped telling the story.
Fair Street was not alone. Black business districts across the country faltered in the 1970s. Of course, it wasn't just integration that caused this. Downtowns all over America were emptying as businesses fled to the suburbs. Gene Lee from the Big Apple says it was like watching this giant ripple effect of hardship.
It just went from the black community to the downtown community to nothing.
Fair Street was put on the National Register of Historic Places, but it's still empty. A mix of the economic downturn and expensive repairs to infrastructure has stalled redevelopment efforts. But maybe more than anything, it seems as if no one in Jackson can agree on what Fair Street should be.
I don't want a Beale Street. I don't want a Bourbon Street. I want Fair Street.
The best thing you can do is give lots of small business people a shot. If Fair Street is going to depend on locals, it's going to go broke.
I have hopes for it being a good nighttime venue.
Jackson cannot support an entertainment district.
And I hope and pray that one day that Fair Street will become Fair Street again.
It's like there isn't a consensus on what Fair Street should mean, what role it should have now. And in the meantime, it is a daily reminder of dreams unfulfilled. Back at the Big Apple Inn, Gino Lee says they've stayed open here because of a generations-long commitment to the area, providing people with those pig ears. But their building is falling apart, and many people avoid Fair Street.
My oldest child, who's in high school right now, does not like coming to the Big Apple Inn because it's in a poor section of town, and she's afraid of the area.
That is a far cry from the outcome the civil rights activists imagined. The Fair Street story complicates the legacy of civil rights in a way that, as a nation, I think we're uncomfortable with, because it pushes up against the narrative we've created. I think most of us would agree that abolishing segregation was the right thing to do, but on the flip side, the separation, at least here in Jackson, forced the black community to be tight, to rely on one another, to support their own businesses. Without it, that unity dissipated. Luther King says that whatever is done with Fair Street, that unity is what needs to be resurrected.
Because we understood who we were as a people. We understood our contributions. We understood our value. So we've got to reshape the narrative, refocus the narrative, get the narrative back to where it used to be.
Coming up on State of the Reunion, one woman's story of having to totally rewrite the narrative of who she thought she was. That's ahead on State of the Reunion. Support for State of the Reunion comes from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting and PRX, the Public Radio Exchange, a growing network of listeners, producers, and stations collaborating to make public radio more public. PRX.org.
On the next Illinois Pioneers on WYLL-TV, I sit down with Fred Kumero, Professor Emeritus of Comparative Biosciences at the University of Illinois. Since the late 50s, he's argued that trans fats found in a wide range of processed foods are more likely than cholesterol to cause heart disease. Few people listened at first, but now, over 50 years later, the FDA is finally catching up. I'm David Inge. Join me for Illinois Pioneers Thursday night at 7:30 on WYLL-TV.
Support for today's broadcast comes from the Unitarian Universalist Church of Urbana-Champaign, on the corner of Green and Birch in Urbana, where progressive religion has had a home for more than 150 years. More information is on the web at uucuc.org, or visit on Sunday mornings before services.
You're listening to State of the Reunion. I'm Al Letson, and this hour we are looking to redefine Black History Month by telling stories that shift the narrative or reveal something different that we normally don't think about during February. Take, for instance, the music of the Civil Rights Movement. Now, you probably think of this.
We shall overcome.
Some songs have become as iconic of the movement as figures like Dr. Martin Luther King Jr., but how about this one? Land of a Thousand Dances? Not so much. But then came the Civil Rights remix.
Do you want your freedom? Oh yeah. You fight for your freedom? Oh yeah. You know, and of course, the song itself is about, you know, doing the pony, oh yeah, Boney Maroney, oh yeah, you know.
There was a whole lot more to the music of the Civil Rights Movement than the spirituals and folk songs we've all heard. Jimmy Collier was a musician in the movement, playing his guitar all over the country.
The song that I'm most known for is a song called Burn Baby Burn.
Middle of the summer, midnight flies and
I did concerts. I sang songs on picket lines. I sang in people's living rooms. You know, whatever the situation called for.
Music was in almost every part of the movement, Jimmy says. And not just for musicians. Everybody sang.
We would often start a meeting with some kind of music. And we always tried to end with singing because that kept people from fighting at the end of the meeting.
But not every audience could be moved with the spirituals and the folk songs most of us remember.
In the South, young people were more involved in church activities, church music, and so on. And in the North, where we were dealing with gangs and people that were not so much a part of the church, R&B songs really made us seem credible.
And so Jimmy and other singers would make slight alterations to the lyrics to fit their message. Ray Charles' song Moving On, about getting over a bad romance, became a song about moving beyond racism. Or this R&B tune, which was popular back then, from Little Willie John, You Better Leave My Kitten Alone.
You better leave my kitten alone.
Switch out the word for kitten for segregation, and bam!
You better leave segregation alone. Because they love segregation like a hound dog love a bone.
In the end, Jimmy Collier says, it was all about finding the right vehicle for people to hear the message, to get excited and join the cause.
Because that's really what it's about. How many, you know, what are the numbers that you can get involved? And so people will adapt and create the tools that they need in order to get mass involvement.
A hound dog love a bone.
Jimmy Collier rewrote songs for the movement, transforming pop culture, turning it into a tool of change. Our next storyteller has done something similar, at least kind of. Artist Damali Ayo has rewritten her race.
Becoming Multiracial, Rewriting My Identity in 6 Chapters.
Chapter 1, My Life as a Professional Black Person.
For the last 15 years, I have been a professional black person. On second thought, make that the last 42 years. As a speaker, I give talks titled, You Can Fix Racism, for MLK Day and Black History Month all around the country.
Please welcome Damali Ayo.
As a conceptual artist, I asked hardware stores to match paint to my skin color.
Well, it sounds like you didn't mix any paint color, right?
Just about anything. You give me something, I'll do the best I can with it.
As a performance artist, I panhandled on the street for slavery reparations. I asked white strangers to give me money that I paid out to black people as they passed by.
It's kind of a do-it-yourself approach. You guys want to pay some reparations today? Do you want to pay some reparations?
I wrote 2 books on racism and even corrected Bill O'Reilly on how to pronounce my name.
With us now, the book's author, Damali Ayo. All right.
Actually, Damali.
Is it Damali? Mm-hmm. I'm sorry. It's the African names don't come easy to this Irish guy. Sean, I can handle.
Everything I did was about being a black person in a racist world. It made me exhausted and depressed. I tried a couple of times to get out of race work, but it felt like the only thing I could get paid for was being black. It was the profession I had been groomed for my entire life.
Chapter 2, A Foot Soldier in the Race War.
I was one of a handful of black students at a predominantly white school. I was considered a mascot for my race, a poster child for blackness. Every report I did was on black history, a black person, or a black achievement. In kindergarten, I integrated my school's doll collection with the black Raggedy Ann and Andy. My teachers walked on eggshells in fear that they would offend or damage this little specimen of blackness, but they did, all the time. When the second grade had IQ tests, the school suggested I be retested. My high score must have been a fluke. My mom prepared me for the daily race war I faced each time I left our base camp called home. In our house, Africa always faced out on the globe, and the black chess pieces made the first move. We had a Black History bulletin board and flashcards. I memorized the accomplishments of Black heroes, knowing Mom would quiz me later and be angry when I didn't know the answers. Mom didn't even let us eat white bread. Not because it lacked nutrients, because it was white.
Chapter 3. Something Doesn't Add Up.
Both of my dad's parents are African American, with some Blackfeet Native American on both sides. I always knew that my militant Black mother was part white, although I never met either of my grandparents. Mom's mother was English. Mom said that her father was Black. My mother is very light-skinned with wavy brown hair and is often perceived by others to be white. I spent my childhood explaining to classmates, friends, teachers, even to Mom's hairdresser, that no matter what she looked like, no matter where her parents came from, my mom was Black. On one of my college applications, you could check as many of those little race boxes as apply to you. You didn't have to choose just one. I wanted to check African American, Native American, and I nervously asked Mom if I could check the box marked white. She exploded. "You are Black, and that is the only box you will check."
Chapter 4. The Truth Reveals Itself.
20 years later, I got a call from my middle sister. Mom had been acting strange, forgetting things, mixing up words. It was dementia. Mom's brain had begun the slow, painful process of unraveling bit by bit. Mom called her three daughters together at the end of that year. She wanted to tell us her family history. Soon she would be unable to remember it. We sat around a squat square table in the den. Mom passed around old photos. I put a tape recorder in the center of the table.
"My grandmother that I've never seen died during the flu epidemic."
"That's Philomena."
"Yes, that's Philomena."
"Really?"
"Yes."
"That's your grandmother?"
"That,
died
yes."
"Of the swine flu."
"Yes."
"Epidemic." "I had never heard of Philomena."
"Oh, okay, well."
"This is in Italy."
"Italy,
she's the Italian." "That's a whole other thing I have to get through."
"This is your dad's mom." "No, she was here in the United States."
Mom continued, shifting her focus to her grandfather. She had told me before that his name was Jimmy Rose.
"So anyway, that's my grandfather. You'll be able to look through this. A bunch of pictures of me."
"What was his first name, your grandfather?"
"Well, God, his name, Vincenzo."
"Vincent."
"What?" "Just hang on. Vincenzo Rosanio. It's very confusing."
This was a part of my family I had never heard about. I stared at this photo. A small family of immigrants posed in their best clothes. They looked like they belonged in a documentary. This was where Mom's Black blood was supposed to be. In reality, there wasn't any, not that I could see. My relatives had arrived here from Naples. I was the great-granddaughter of Italian immigrants. When I returned to LA, I looked at the world a little differently. I felt an odd sense of calm. I had been carrying a lot of anger from my race war battle scars, but having this information didn't create more internal conflict. It created peace. It felt like the simple truth. It answered small but lifelong questions like why my nose is shaped the way it is, flat from the front like my African ancestors, and long and hunkin' from the side like my grandfather's big Italian nose.
Chapter 5. A Whole Nother Level.
It was good to have a better understanding of where I came from, but I never thought to question my racial identity, not in any major way. Then someone questioned it for me.
"Are you Black?"
It wasn't the first time I had been asked this. I had been stalked by these kinds of questions my whole life.
"Are you Black?"
"What race are you?"
"You kinda different."
This had always made me angry. I felt like people were asking to see my Black card or kicking me out of the race. But this time it felt different. A gush of clarity came over me like a strong wind. I took a deep breath and said out loud, "Oh my God. I'm half white." Instantly, a second chorus of voices ran through my head, the voices of my multiracial friends.
People get confused by the way I look.
I have to be an expert in both cultures, but I don't really fit into either.
I am neither nor.
I am both and.
My life flashed before me. Each voice, each description was instantly matched by a part of my life that was just like that. A second wind of clarity came over me. Oh, I said out loud again. I'm multiracial. The next day, I wrote two multiracial friends from college and told them of my epiphanies. They happily welcomed me to my new self. They had tried to get me to join our campus multiracial group 20 years ago, but I didn't think I fit in. One of them sent me the Bill of Rights for People of Mixed Heritage by Maria Root. It was remarkable. As I read, tears streamed down my face. I have the right to identify myself differently than how my parents identify me. I have the right to change my identity over my lifetime and more than once. I have the right not to justify my existence in this world. After all these years, this was a new idea. I don't have to prove, explain, promote, or seek permission to be exactly who and what I am. I can just be?
Chapter 6. The Sound of My Own Voice.
As a child, I had always loved to sing. But singing wasn't something that my family valued. But as Mom's dementia progressed, music became one of the few things that could comfort her. I would play old songs to Mom, 70s soul we used to have on 8-track, sappy ballads, and one of her favorite show tunes. One day, after a trip down musical memory lane, I was singing to myself in the kitchen when, from the other room, I heard my mother say something I had never heard anyone in my family say. You have such a beautiful voice. Dementia gives strange gifts like that. It caught me off guard, and it took me back. I missed singing. For my 40th birthday, I sheepishly added voice lessons to my wish list. To my surprise, my mother, father, and sister all gave them to me. My voice was tired and out of practice. It cracked when I tried to hit high notes. My instructor said my voice had become strained from imitating other singers. I had always matched my voice to any singer I was listening to, blending the way I sang into their patterns and pitches, sounding like them instead of like me. It was a chilling metaphor for how I had lived my life. Every week, I struggled, often breaking down in tears in my car afterwards, but slowly, over the course of a few months, something amazing happened. I heard my own voice. It was rough in spots, its range was limited, and it wasn't all that pretty, but it was mine.
When all the dark clouds rolled away, and the sun begins to shine, I see my freedom from across the way.
That summer, I packed up everything and moved to a tiny town north of Los Angeles. A seed of an idea was growing in me. Maybe I could live my life on my own terms. I wanted to be more than a professional representative of my race. Maybe I could be more than a demographic, more than an issue, more than the warrior I had been my whole life. Maybe I could finally be a person.
Yes, it feels like. Yes, it seems like. Yes, it feels like. A brand new day. A brand new day.
You know, I think we've gotten attached to a story about the history of Black America. And it's a pretty good one. The perseverance through slavery, and then the Jim Crow era, Martin Luther King at the March on Washington, and everybody coming together and singing, "We Shall Overcome." And then he gets shot by a bad man. But, you know, we make it to the promised land. I mean, Barack Obama was elected president, as if that was the end of the story. And that couldn't be further from the truth. It oversimplifies the struggle. But it also gives this false solution, like the work has been finished. But it's not. The fact, in my opinion, that we need a month to focus attention on these stories is proof. And even when we do focus, It's on a narrative that makes us feel warm and fuzzy. But that's not the whole of reality. You see, we may be on the road to the promised land, but until we come to terms with the uncomfortable parts of America's history, we'll never get there.
Societies, like most people, they don't like to talk about their failures. We'd rather, you know, present our history as one as this march of progress and all of that.
It's a story that's evolving. I don't think there is a period. It's comma after comma. You know, it's gonna weave its way to something that we have no control of.
There are people who say, why are we still talking about that? It's over. I didn't do it. They think we're living in a post-racial America. They're under that delusion.
We can't continue to beat ourselves up, black and white, over what happened in some of the dark parts of our past. I mean, it's good to remember it, it's good to memorialize it, but it's not good to live in it and dwell in it.
As Americans, we don't have to be afraid of our past. You know, until we come to have more of a common understanding what our past was, we're going to have a hard time in the future moving ahead.
Redefining Black History Month was produced by Delaney Hall and Tina Antolini and edited by Taki Telenitis. The rest of the So True staff is business manager Bree Burge and producer Laura Starcheski. Our intern crew is Catherine Whalen, Nina Feldman, Eric Jones, Kathy Tu, Alessandra Bergerman, and Gabe Graben. Special thanks to the Southern Foodways Alliance, an institute of the Center for Southern Culture at the University of Mississippi, and to Rye Mass, Abby Wendell, and Smithsonian Folkways Recordings. So True is presented by